many of you know who John Paul Sartre is. He is hardly, you know, the dearest friend of the Christian faith. But he has some excellent things to say about writing and why one writes and for whom does one write in a little book of essays called What is Literature? Sartre is one of the founders of the modern existentialist school. He's a French writer, and confessedly and professedly and actively atheistic in his whole approach. But it's not necessary, even taking his definitions of writing and literature, it is not necessary to always take the stance of a man in terms of faith, because sometimes you can understand a great deal from what he says or what he writes or she writes, regardless of what his particular point of view is. As a matter of fact, he does refer in these essays to the relationship of reading, even to the scriptures themselves, and not in a particularly negative way. It's quite an eye-opener, I think, would be an eye-opener for many Christians to read a couple of these chapters just because of that. But I know that it's sometimes hard to find books like this, especially when you want them, and I'm going to take a little time this morning to read some passages from this to give you an idea of a little bit of what I was saying yesterday in terms of the way in which we also share in the creation of that which we read. And I went into this in terms of the novels of Charles Williams and the fact that unless you put yourself into these books and into what is going on, they are going to be rather a blank. But it requires the projection of the imagination and of all of your experiences, which also are sort of the flesh and blood of your imagination too, to go into the recreation of these novels or any novel that you read, simply because the act of writing on the part of the writer is not enough. The reader must participate in that which is written. Unless, of course, it's just a comic book variety in which you watch it happen to you, and it doesn't really happen to you. It's just something that engages your interest for a short time. I want to read a couple of passages because they are a good introduction to the to what I'm going to say this morning about Charles Williams, and also because I think that, in a real sense, it led to this particular seminar this weekend on language, because when I first talked to Leo about it and read, he had listened to a discussion that I was having on existentialism with some of the lifestyle people, and he was really taken with this particular statement by Sartre, and said, you know, we really have to have a discussion on language again. Really have to have a discussion on that again. So it's 6 years since we've discussed language as such, and this is what we're into again. The two chapters that I'm most concerned about here, because they're less specific than the ones that come later, have to do with what is writing, why does one write, and for whom. What Sartre says is, the fact is, it seems that nobody has ever asked himself these questions. Why are you writing, and for whom are you writing in particular? First quotation, the first part that I want to read is from the second chapter, which is on why write. And this is what he says. It is not true that one writes for himself. That would be the worst blow. The operation of writing implies that of reading as its dialectical correlative. In other words, it's a two-way thing that goes on in the writing of the book or the story or whatever, and the reading on our part. There is no art except for and by others. Reading seems, in fact, to be the synthesis of perception and creation. It supposes the essentiality of both the subject and the object. In other words, there has to be the subject, there's got to be a person reading it, and the object, has got to be there. Now, you could also think of it in the other way, that the material that's read is the subject, and we are the object, because in a sense we're being worked on by that which has been written. And the important thing is that the meaning is not just contained in the words, since it is the person who reads the words who allows the signification or the meaning or the significance of each of them to be understood. And the literary object, though realized through language, is never given in any language. Now, is it maybe hard to get this when somebody reads it to you, because it's very concentrated material, but it's not just, well, you know yourself, you can read a paragraph and you read all the words and you know what all those words mean.
But they mean nothing.
But they mean nothing. They haven't happened to you. So then you have to go back over it. And then somebody interrupts you. So then you have to go back over it again. And the words are there, the language is there, but the meaning has simply not come through those words and that language, because you and I have not participated in it. It takes a great deal of energy to read a book. In short, the reader goes by certain landmarks in the material that he reads, the landmarks that the writer has set out for him, but that's not enough. He has to unite these landmarks to some parts of himself. He must go beyond them. In short, reading is directed creation. Now, you can see there's a lot involved in reading. Then it's not just something. This is not just quick newspaper reading or glancing at a few things that you are trying to kind of keep in mind for the present time. And he discusses, for instance, Raskolnikov, you know, from Crime and Punishment. And he says, on the one hand, the literary object has no other substance than the reader's subjectivity. Raskolnikov's waiting is my waiting, which I lend to him. Without this impatience of the reader, he, the character of Raskolnikov, would remain only a collection of signs. His hatred of the police magistrate who questions him is my hatred, which has been solicited and wheedled out of me by signs, in other words, by words. And the police magistrate himself would not exist without the hatred I have for him via Raskolnikov. That is what animates him. It is his very flesh. But on the other hand, the words are there like traps to arouse our feelings and to reflect them toward us. Each word is a path of transcendence. It shapes our feelings, names them, and attributes them to an imaginary personage who takes it upon himself to live them for us, and who has no other substance than these borrowed passions. He confers objects, perspectives, and a horizon upon it. Since the creation can find its fulfillment only in reading, since the artist must entrust to another the job of carrying out what he has begun, since it is only through the consciousness of the reader that he can regard himself as essential to his work, all literary work is an appeal. Now, Just think about that when you wonder why you don't care about reading. Well, maybe you just don't care to answer the appeal. You know, it requires a response on your part to do something with what is there. This doesn't mean necessarily an ethical appeal. You don't have to go out and change something or do something about it. It isn't always that. It's simply that it's an appeal to your imagination, to the energies of your mind and your emotions to take part in something. To write is to make an appeal to the reader that he lead into objective existence the revelation which I have undertaken by means of language. And then he goes on to come to the point of why we felt that bicentennially this was a good thing for us to think about this year. He says, and since this directed creation is an absolute beginning. Now, you remember I said Sartre considers reading as directed creation. Since this is directed creation is an absolute beginning, it is therefore brought about by the freedom of the reader and by what is purest in that freedom. Thus the writer appeals to the reader's freedom to collaborate in the production of his work. It will doubtless be said that all tools address themselves to our freedom since they are the instruments of a possible action. And so the work of art is not unique in that. It's true. The tool is the congealed outline of an operation. But I may use a hammer to nail up a case or to hit my neighbor over the head. Insofar as I consider it in itself, it is not an appeal to my freedom. It does not put me face to face with it. Rather, it aims at using it by substituting a succession of traditional procedures for the free invention of means. In other words, you don't instinctively take up the hammer and hit somebody with it. Your instinctive use of the hammer is to hammer a nail and put something together. The book does not serve my freedom, it requires it. Instead, one cannot address himself to freedom as such by means of constraint, fascination, or entreaties. There is only one way of attaining it. First, by recognizing it, then having confidence in it, and finally requiring of it an act in his own name, in its own name, that is, in the name of the confidence that one brings to it. In other words, that you and I are able to bring this freedom into play when we are able to choose to read this material and say, I am willing and I will to become involved in it so that the book becomes a living thing for me. You are perfectly free to leave the book on the table. Now don't forget that. You are perfectly free to leave the book on the table, but if you open it, you assume responsibility for it. For freedom is not experienced by its enjoying its free subjective functioning. In other words, you don't enjoy freedom by saying, oh, it's so nice to be free. I mean, what's that? I mean, you just simply meditate on the word freedom and say freedom, 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 freedom. And then do you know what freedom is? No, you don't. You only enjoy freedom by in a creative act required by an imperative such as this appeal is. This absolute end, this imperative which is transcendent yet acquiesced in, which freedom itself adopts as its own, is what we call a value. The work of art is a value because it is an appeal. And then I really like this particular part in which I say he does have a sense of where the Christian truth and the Christian faith has had a reality in all this that he has to draw on because there is no better thing to refer to, no matter who people are, no matter what their beliefs. All the feelings that you have in terms of a book or a novel or whatever that you're reading have their origin in freedom. They are loaned. The belief which I accord the tale or the story is freely assented to by me. It is a passion in the Christian sense of the word. That is a freedom which resolutely puts itself into a state of passivity to obtain a certain transcendent effect by this sacrifice. In other words, it's the kind of thing that you really allow yourself vigorously and totally and passionately to enter into. Now, you see why we feel that reading is something that people could come up here and talk about, and it's not just a little, you know, well, it's something nice to pass the time with if the weather's bad. Well, fortunately, the weather's beautiful today, and you still came in to just think about this. But, I mean, it's not something that is a periphery thing. It's not peripheral to human existence. It's bound up to our whole beingness. And Sartre is much concerned about the matter of being, but we're not going into that. The importance of understanding that reading and entering into a novel or a story or any kind of writing that requires the imagination and requires an identification does require a kind of passionate willingness to allow oneself to become a part of it. In other words, you bring a lot to it, but you also allow it to act upon you. And you don't sit there all tight saying, I don't like this. I don't approve of this. If you don't approve of it, put the book down and stop if you can't manage it. But if you can allow it to enter into your system a little bit and think about it and happen to you, then when you finish it, you have a good reason not to approve of it or to find that you've gained something in reality from it. The argument always is absurd that you have to believe in your story, if otherwise it's intolerable. If you don't believe in it, it's ridiculous. But that's not necessarily true, because you don't have a kind of a total belief in a story that is fiction. It's not thinking that this is the truth and I wonder, am I believing a lie? I mean, you know it's fiction. You know it's not factual truth. But you continually renew your choice to believe in it. It's what Sartre calls a free dream. You have the possibility always of withdrawing from it and saying, I'm not going to take any more of that. I'm through with it. And you put the book down and you close it. But on the other hand, if you want to allow it to continue to happen to you, if you feel that it's valid and worthwhile, you go along with it. And if something does happen that is real. And that is why we see people who are known for their toughness shed tears at the recital of imaginary misfortunes. They know they're not true. And this happens in movies, as we all know. For the moment, they have become what they would have been if they had not spent their lives hiding their freedom from themselves. Now, you know, this is true. I think that's one reason I have trouble with novels, because I, lots of times, hide from what is going on in the novel, and I just don't want to let that be true, you know, for me too. And it's something when it happens that somebody actually can weep over what they're reading, because in a real sense that's an experience that may have a later effect on them. Something softens inside of us when we weep tears, whether it's about something that we say, oh, it's sentimental drivel, you know, it's just something somebody wrote. But if it's really good, solid writing, and if the emotions therefore are generated are real ones, you know, something happens to you. So he says there is a real paradox here all the time, that you're aware of the unbelief that it's not true and yet it is true. There's a continual paradox in that. But there's also the feeling that sometimes the more the writer demands of you, the more we demand of him. And this I thought of in particular with Charles Williams's writings, because he demands a great deal of the reader, and yet at the same time you demand a great deal of him as you read his books, because you think he's got to have said this in this particular way in order for me to understand something, and you reread it. You reread a section in order to really get it through to you. Well, the I think it's interesting to read something like this simply because it helps all of us to know that reading is a passionate state of mind, like Eric Hofer says about the life of liberty and human beingness. There something happens to everyone who allows that kind of reading to happen to him. And there's a great deal more that Sartre discusses in terms of freedom and its relationship to democracy and the totalitarian state. He has an excellent little example here that I think I should read in conclusion, simply because it will tie in with, if I give Carol any time, to just the little bit on the politics of language. He says this: a blacksmith can be affected by fascism in his life as a man, but not necessarily in his craft. A writer will be affected in both, and even more in his craft than in his life. In other words, and he was speaking particularly to the point of France under the Nazis, and the fact that after all, a man could be a supporter of the underground movement and be a blacksmith, and the Nazis need not know how he felt unless he betrayed the fact that he was also doing blacksmith work for the underground. But on the other hand, a writer had no way of expressing his craft without the Nazis recognizing who he was. And he says, he uses as an example a man who was a famous journalist in particular at this time. He was sincerely a Nazi in the French regime. The first few months he reprimanded, rebuked, and lectured his countrymen, and no one dared to tell him what they thought about it. He was a real Quisling in the sense of what we know that word, its use now. No one answered him, so there was no dialogue, there was no dialectic. No one answered him because no one was free to do so. He became irritated. He no longer felt his readers. He became more insistent, but no sign appeared to prove that he had been understood. No sign of hatred or anger, nothing. He was disoriented, the victim of a growing distress. He complained to the Germans. His articles had been superb. They became shrill. The moment arrived when he struck his breast. No echo, except among the bought journalists whom he despised. He handed in his resignation, withdrew it, again spoke, still in the desert. Finally, he kept still, gagged by the silence of others. He had demanded the enslavement of others, but in his crazy mind, he must have imagined that it was voluntary, that it was still free. You see, I mean, that somehow he could do this kind of writing as a journalist, and in a controlled country such as a totalitarian state is, and as France was under the Nazis, there was no free response to any kind of writing. Finally, it came. The man in him congratulated himself mightily that he'd done very well. He'd avoided being killed, and he'd, you know, so on. But the writer could not bear it. While this was going on, others who happily were in the majority understood that the freedom of writing implies the freedom of the citizen. One does not write for slaves. The art of prose is bound up with the only regime in which prose has meaning, democracy. And this is why Solzhenitsyn had to leave Russia. When one is threatened, the other is too. And it is not enough to defend them with a pen. A day comes when the pen is forced to stop and the writer must then take up arms. But I want you to think about that through this weekend, those of you who are going to be here and those of you who are going can still think about it on your own, that prose is indeed written in a democracy if it is true prose, if it's real. And this is what everyone realizes, because it demands a freedom of response. Now, that kind of response is not, as I say, is not always an ethical one. Sartre ends his particular chapter with the fact that that kind of demand for freedom will not just end with the pen, it will also mean sometime that you will have to defend that freedom if you feel it is worth it, or defend it with laying down your life if you feel that pacifism is your way to do it. But what I want you to think about this morning, particularly in the last part of the hour, is the first chapter of the that we read, the sections from the first chapter from Sartre, and that was that when we enter into reading, we enter it with passion, and we enter it with the idea that we are co-creators with the writer. And in a real sense, this is also a symbol, you might say, of one of Charles Williams's great themes, which is that of co-inherence. He felt very strongly that, now that sounds like a big term, and it is a big term because it includes everything from the incarnation and the sex act and the relationship of people to people in sharing one another's burden. And it also, in a real sense, is what happens when we are having this relationship in reading, that we are entering into the material that's been written, and in a sense what the author has written is entering into us. So there's a kind of a locking together here, a producing of something new out of that, because the book you read is not the same as the book I read, although the titles are the same. Yesterday we talked a great deal about the images that the way in which Charles Williams, this English writer, used the concept of the image. And I referred to the fact that in a real sense, you and I live the life of images, now of imagery. Now, it's very hard for us to straighten out that word in our minds, because we always think of images as graven images, or we think of imagery as something that's just an illustration of something else. The way in which we have to remember it is that we are created in the image of God. Now, that is not an image in a graven sense. We've got flesh and blood in us, and we've got the power of spirit, we have the freedom of will, we have the power to think and imagine and discover. We have all these things because we are created in the image of God. Also, we are allowed to live our lives out in the image of God, and yet we can forget completely that we are related to Him. And other people can forget that we are created in the image of God, because there's nothing particularly that either they don't know God or they don't know us, so they don't make any transference in those relationships. The important thing to remember that when we talk about an author who is using images or the way of images in writing, let's remember that this is not something that is taking away from the truth, but it's something that simply is the way in which truth is embodied over a certain period of time within a certain structure. And this is what the novels of Charles Williams do. They have a life of their own, just as you and I have a life of our own. They also have a relationship to their origin, to what they really are pointing towards. And all of Charles Williams' novels are bound up in the Christian faith and the way in which the Christian life must be lived. And so too our lives can be thought, if we think about them that way, are definitely related to Him who is the creator of us. And so our lives are lived out in a whole organization of His making, unless we forget Him entirely. And it's possible to do this. So there are different ways of interpreting these images in these novels. But the important thing, I think, is to remember that they are not literal, any more than you and I can really say that we are in His steps, as that famous old book of Charles Sheldon was. In other words, that we don't We don't walk around and look like Jesus Christ, nor do we do exactly the same things as he does, nor do we live in Palestine, nor are we Jews. None of these things are we that he was. And yet, in a sense, we do have, if we are baptized into him and live in him in a daily communion, fed by the Eucharist, we are in a real sense have a hidden life that is expressing itself in a lot of different ways, sometimes completely unrevealed to the world about, because we can't go around and say, look, I belong to Jesus, and that's why I'm doing this. You know, you'd lose all the value of it if you continually said, the reason I'm being good to you is because I'm a Christian. It isn't because I like you. What kind of effect would you have on people? You know, maybe they'd be drawn to Jesus Christ, and maybe they wouldn't. If they felt that it made you less human, then they felt they had a right to expect from you. But the thing is that the hiddenness of Christ doesn't stay hidden. It comes out because it pushes you to extremes that you do not anticipate. And these things happen also in Charles Williams's novels. And it doesn't mean, and I'm going to the end of this in a rather lot of detail, simply because I had a good conversation afterwards, and somebody said to me, look, what does that do to the use of Scripture in our home and in our background and even in our conversation? In no way does this deny the validity or the importance of Scripture or its meaning or its use in conversation or whenever it's available or possible to be used. All that Charles Williams is doing is writing a book that can be available and read by someone who's willing to enter into that book. And because of the fact that it isn't propaganda as such, I mean, everything isn't stated so that right away somebody draws back and says, that's Christian stuff. I'm not a Christian, and I think it's a lot of tomfoolery, and I'm not going to read it. But the fact that he doesn't do this, the fact that the novel, as it's written, is exciting and interesting in and of itself, can draw somebody into it, and indeed it is a bait. But he doesn't write it simply as a bait. He writes it because it's a good story, and it actually, if you're a Christian, or if you allow it to work upon you, you find that a great deal of what is said is deeply involved in the stuff of life and expands itself into a lot of different areas that a Christian must live and operate in. So don't think for one minute that this implies that it doesn't matter if you know any Scripture. As long as you know the general ideas of Christianity, you know that's enough. Charles Williams wrote two books on doctrine. And they are rather odd, naturally, because he's an odd person. And certainly I don't think any of you need to think that you take any of these novels, or a lot of the novels that you don't take those as literal truth. You suspend your belief for the time being while you read them. That does not mean that they aren't going to have a great effect on your imagination and on your thoughts, and eventually on your life. But he did write two books, a double book called He Came Down from Heaven and The Forgiveness of Sins, which is the life from the biblical backgrounds in the Old Testament through the New Testament. And then he wrote The Descent of the Dove, which is really the story of the Christian church and how the Holy Spirit acted upon the believers and what happened in the life of the world because of the descent of the dove. In other words, the movement and the meaning of the Holy Spirit in the Christian church. So
that, by the way, that book, it gets quoted by everybody. Non-Christians have read that all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews know it. Eric Fromm uses it.
Oh, does he?
Salyer uses it in Hidden Remnant. It's a rather fascinating book, and it's really intrigued the minds of men wherever men read. That's The Descent of the Dove.
The Forgiveness of Sins, which I hope to quote from, if I ever get to it, is excellent because of the fact that and I think in many ways better than The Descent of the Dove, because he deals with the Scriptures in the Old Testament and the New in a remarkable way. And I thought that rather than go on and develop so much of his novels themselves, I thought perhaps it would help us all to share some of the ways in which these great concepts that he dealt with and that he made very actual in his novels, how he explained them in his essays and in, for instance, in The Forgiveness of Sins, because they have a definite application to our own lives as Christians. For example, a couple of things on this whole use of images. I think a couple more illustrations might help you. He says, for example, it's not just the images in terms of our lives, such as the novels are, for instance, a story of a number of different lives in a number of different situations. He says, for instance, you could look at the day today. What a terrific day it is. Beautiful skies, clouds, everything, just, you know, bright and glorious. That doesn't mean that you right away think the word victorious. I mean, you might just go out and say, that's just really a beautiful day, and have no reference at all to God who made the day. Not everybody says, my God, how wonderful thou art, when they look at a sunset. But he says, this is the problem with things in nature. You can just enjoy them as such. This is also the problem in all kinds of imagery, in all kinds of novels, in all kinds of poetry. You can enjoy them in and of themselves and forget entirely about a point of reference that is really the basis for that whole thing. In other words, God in Christ, who is the whole point and center and fountain of everything that had been written or described or expressed in that particular way. And he's very insistent that we be aware of the fact that images as such, fiction, novels, art, whatever, can be an end in themselves and lose themselves in it. Even theological knowledge can be an end in itself. And you can just think how much fun it is to know all this and get and be absolutely go nowhere in terms of the real life that God expects you to live. So he says anything can be an end in itself, and an image or whatever can simply stop right there, and then it becomes a total trap, and it's no longer a part of the life of God unless it has a chance to go on. He says too that, for instance, that something that is really, I think, interesting, that very often we think of the Christian life as something that should be peeled off. That is, you know, you want to get rid of as much as possible of the hampering things of you know, the physical. If we could just get free of that and just be clear to be in the Spirit, you know, then we'd be, you know, then we'd really be close to God. And he said that's what a lot of the monastic groups thought. The many of the Roman Catholic mystics and the mystics of the early church felt that this was the way to do it, and he calls it the negation of images. In other words, it's the cutting away of anything that looks like it might refer to something, so that you go on a direct line, straight, get rid of everything that's in the way and go on a direct line to God. Of course, he says that does end up in a rather bad situation, because what it ends up in is a Gnosticism, in which you go from circle to circle to circle of improvements until finally you reach the great all or center, which is God, and you are able to have thrown off all the things that trap you. And he says, this is very, very good and you know, a great thing to think about. But he said, that's the kind of thing that the Gnostics got into, and why they could not bear the actuality of the incarnation, and why they really were denying in every respect the reality of the creation itself, the affirmation of the fact that God said that it was good. I mean, you want to push this away because you realize that there's something greater beyond, and you're taking into your hands that which God, if he felt that that was what we should know, why would he have gone to the trouble of the incarnation with all of its suffering and blood and misery? And William says, well, he says, actually, you know, I realize that celibacy is a great thing, you know, for some of the priests and the nuns and the brothers. But he says, you know, I really do think that the affirmation of the body in marriage can be just as laborious as rejecting it in celibacy. And you know what Luther, well, now some of you may not, if you're not married, you don't know that that is a possibility. that it is that marriage can be a labor, that it is not just something that it is a real, it is real work, as Luther said. This is what we need in order to really perfect ourselves, is live with another person. And maybe it's quicker not to have to do that, but Williams is in doubt about that, because he really does believe that that the relationship of man and woman is indeed a way of expression of God's love for man, and he is very much affirms that. I'm going to skip now to his understanding of the way of exchange or the way of coherence, because although you may think this is a difficult thing to think about, you think about it all the time when you think about the cross. Because what do we say happens on the cross? A substitution is made, is it not? In other words, Christ is substituted, has substituted himself for us. Instead of our being on the cross, he is there. And it is the cross that is the center of William's theology. He out from that springs all these understandings and explanations and character formations and situations that prove and expand the meaning of the way of exchange. In other words, I exchange, if I have been able to lay my burdens on the Lord, then I should be free, as we say up here, to carry the burdens of my brother. But that's not just a generalization. This is something that has to be taken in specifics. You can't just say it as if, you know, a kind of a broad term that you believe in, but it's something that you act out, that you take on. And as yesterday we talked about the way in which some of these characters in Williams's novels actually take on the fears and the problems of some of the other characters, and in a real sense care for them so that they are able to walk free, and they are in reality becoming what Luther says Christ for each other. All Williams is doing is spelling out in an imaginative way that which Luther proclaimed continually, that we are freed in order that we can be little Christs. And it sounds like a great, huge, almost arrogant word to use to apply that to ourselves, but we do not apply it to ourselves because it's God himself who gives it to us. And Williams says this is the kind of privilege and opportunity we have in our living. And this is what his novels are about. Now, I'm not saying you have to read his novels in order to have this happen to you, but I think that you can find it in a lot of other novels. It's interesting to read many, many writers and see who is the redemptive character in that particular book. I mean, becoming aware of someone who actually is carrying the cross, in a sense, for somebody else, carrying the life of someone else, is that's an exciting part of reading fiction. And I'm not saying that Williams is the person you have to read, but in a real sense, he kind of symbolizes what a lot of writers are doing in other ways. I'd like to read a couple of things from The Forgiveness of Sins, because they explain a lot of what he is referring to when he talks about this whole understanding of coherence and the way of exchange. Now, how did, when God created man, what did he do to him to make him something more than a solid mass of animal? He blew into him. He breathed into him. And this is in a real sense, the coherence act, the inherence of God's breath into man. All right, when that happened at creation, then Eve came out of man, right? So there is a continual relationship with God and man and woman as they're created and formed. so that in a real sense, God co-inheres with man. And he expects this breath of his life to have an effect. And when Adam and Eve sinned and lost the first innocence and lost their relationship with God, something very definite happened. Now, we all know what happened, but I want to read something that William says about this, because I think that we don't always think about it this way. When we think about reading about the taking on of the tree of knowledge, man knew that he wasn't supposed to take this fruit. And you remember what the devil said? Oh, you know, that's not true. And he says, you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Unfortunately, to be as gods meant for the Adam to die. For to know evil for them was to know it not by pure intelligence, as God did, but by experience. In other words, man could not know evil just simply as an abstract out here. Well, now I know what evil is. You don't know evil until you experience it. This is what the human being had to realize. And this is what William explains that. It was precisely to experience the opposite of good, the slow destruction of the good, and of themselves with the good. And this is, I think, kind of an interesting angle. You don't have to take it as this isn't a doctrinal statement from our church or anybody particularly, but this is just an imaginative way of trying to understand what happened in the Garden of Eden with this. I mean, we all know it wasn't that the bite of an apple doesn't necessarily, change your whole way of life. But in a sense, it does change our whole way of life, and it did. This was the beginning. Then that's the first theme in the Bible, is this loss of relationship with God in losing obedience, in the act of disobedience. And then he says the thing that happened after that is the tremendous sin of Cain and Abel. And he says the great second theme of the Bible, the theme of community. And this is where the way of exchange starts, the way of co-inheritance has begun in a real sense. But now comes the way of exchange as this divine breath of God is pushed out into human beings, and they are going to live together. And then what happens? It breaks down because sin has its actuality in the killing of Cain, of Abel by Cain. And he says here, from now on, the curse of the primeval choice is now fully at work, and the lasting crisis of that curse continually recurs throughout the scriptures and throughout all of the life of man. From now on, man becomes men. In other words, now it's not just one man, but men that are scattered over the earth. And he explains that with Noah, it begins the response, the responsibility of man for man. For the Lord adds to the threat against Cain and combines something new of its own. It proclaims a law: at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. In other words, that no longer is it the exchange of joy, of delight with each other, and that we share each other's joys and burdens out of love, but there has come the burden of responsibility, and that when because I know I have said, am I my brother's keeper? And have disavowed that kind of relationship of joy, of tending my brother, I now have the responsibility of his life at my hand. And you see, there is no longer the kind of delightful joy that is evidenced in a relationship of God with his people and with one another is lost from that time on. The importance of this way of exchange from the very beginning of Scripture goes on right through the promises of the Messiah, and then finally when Christ comes and is on the cross, and he definitely takes on our sin, and then we move out from that into our life as a way of exchange. From that time on, from the time of Christ's willingness to substitute for us, we are enabled to live, not the way the Old Testament people were unable. We have the new power to live this way of exchange, William says, and we are able to live not only for others, but what is much harder, to live from others. Now, I don't know how you feel, but I find it very hard to be forgiven by somebody else. I don't mind forgiving other people, but I think it's hard to be forgiven. Have you ever thought of the word tolerant? Tolerate. How often is that used in the passive by you or me? Well, I hope I will be tolerated. Or most of the time, we're always talking about, you know, well, I am a tolerant person. I can tolerate people like that. But have we ever thought that other people have to tolerate us? And that's a very hard thing for us to swallow. And he says this is also true in much more intensity with the thought that you and I also have to be forgiven by other people. Otherwise, our forgiveness means very little. Because if we don't understand what it means to be forgiven, there's a big lack in our humility. It's much easier to be right and righteous and, you know, up here and able to, you know, pat people on the head and say, I understand, you know, I've gone through that too, but of course I'm up here ahead of you. But the fact that we're on the same level and that sometimes I'm lower than you are, that's hard to recognize. But that is as much a part of the way of exchange as it is as the other is. It's not just that I put myself out for you, but that I am willing to have you put yourself out for me and not say, oh, no, I don't need that. See, I mean, that's our instinctive sense of personal pride that can't stand having somebody else take something over for us. This is very much woven into the needs of all of us. And I think if you think of the fact that, for instance, Williams uses the fact that when a baby is born, a woman cannot have a baby by herself, nor can a man have a baby by himself. Of course, I read about the fact that there is a possibility of these chemical genes, but but we'll discount that because I don't consider that the reality of creation in that sense. But you see, this is a double thing. One of them has to give up to the other one has to accept something from the other. In a real sense, this is a way of exchange. This is a shared thing. Birth is a shared thing. We are the product of that. And it goes all the way through life, not just physically in terms of money and materialism, and we up here live certainly in an interdependence on other people continually, and our whole planet, in a sense, has never been so interdependent. But more especially in the internalization of relationships with each other, there it comes out even more so. So that kind of thing, we realize that the way of exchange is one in which it's a two-way street. You accept from me and I accept from you. There are times when I need you more than you need me and vice versa. And in this way, we learn to know the way in which lives have to be lived. If they're lived out of the cross, any other way of living Christianity is a lot of empty words and not lived with the passion that even Sartre admitted belonged to the Christian when he's willing to submit to the word from the cross that allows us to have the power to live for each other. Now that sounds like a sermon, but really that is the way Williams writes. He is a preacher, and never does he allow the thought that the whole body of truth that is in the scripture to be, ignored, or that this isn't important. It's of primary importance, but he assumes that this is where people are going to go for their food, and that out of that they are going to be able to bring a passionate state of mind to his writing. Carol, have you got time to... Do you want to bring...
All I want to say is that it was asked after the second section. My opportunity to discuss last night's debate also in terms of our weekend, which I think is extremely useful. He says that the present political chaos is connected to the decay of language. Political language, and with variations, is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give it an appearance of solidity to pure wind. One cannot change all this in a moment, but one can at least change one's own habits. And from time to time, one can, even if one jeers loudly enough, and we had some good jeering last night in the silence, send some worn-out and useless phrase, some jackboot, Achilles heel, hot fed melting pot, acid test, veritable inferno, or other lump of verbal refuse into the dust of the word law. In our age, there's no such thing as keeping out of politics. All issues are political issues, and politics itself is a mass of lies, evasions, folly, hatred, and schizophrenia, where the general atmosphere is bad, language must suffer. The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish squirting out ink. He says the invasion of one's mind by all these stupid phrases that we hear and heard last night can only be prevented if one is constantly on guard against them, and every such phrase anesthetizes a portion of one's brain. Because you can't think any. You destroy your own power to think. Yuri gives a good illustration, I think, quickly, and all you teach will be chuckling at this one, including the Hollis and Dory, I think. Here's a well-known verse of Ecclesiastes. I return and saw unto the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Here it is in modern English. Objective considerations of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that successor failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account.